And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave.
Geez, is it only Tuesday? Is that real?
It's only Tuesday. I'll take it. It's better than being Thursday already.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Well, there's still hope. Hey, listen, happy National Chocolate Cupcake Day.
Oh, yummy, yummy, yummy.
Oh, yeah. Simple dollop of frosting, just one sweet serving to satisfy your craving. Yeah, I found this interesting. Cupcakes can actually be traced back to 1796.
Wow.
When a recipe of a cake to be baked in small cups was written in a book called American Cookery by Amelia Simmons. Although the earliest known documentation of the term cupcake was in 1828 in 75 receipts for pastry cakes and sweetmeats. In Eliza Leslie's Receipts Cookbook. Well, I'm not interested in any of the recipes, Melody. I'm heading out right after the program today to our local cupcake shop to pick up a pair of their chocolate specials for tonight's dessert for my better half and me. I can only say if we lived closer to one another, there'd be three on our table.
Well, I'll just have to wait and see. My sugar for the day was gold.
Yeah.
Well, didn't really fix that sugar craving too bad, but it was up just a tad today. And looking at gold today, right now in the New York spot price aftermarket, up $2 at $16.52. Silver's up 6 cents at $18.81. Did hit 19 for the day. Platinum was down $7 at $917, with palladium up $26 at $2,098. The USDX today, basically unchanged at 112.06. Crude oil was down another $2.30 at 83.17. And the paper markets liked it. You betcha. The Dow was up 337 points. 30,523. The S&P was up over 1% at 3,720. The NASDAQ was just shy of 1% at 10,772. Europe was still all positive overnight. The DAX was only one close to 1%. Asia, Shanghai was lower. 10-year yield, let's see what that little baby did. It's below 4%, 3.992, just a little bit below, 3.992, but it was still down today. And natural gas today, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the program, 5.71, and that was down, still over 4, looks like 4.75%. So got whacked today, and WTI was also down 2.33%, but we had already talked about that. So, yeah, and a lot of interesting things going on,
Can I add one more thing to the market report?
Sure.
I just want to alert readers of our American Survival newsletter that this week's came out last night, and for those of you who follow Melody's weekly market recap, there's a new line in there toward the bottom of the report that actually compares the spread in the 10-year versus the 2-year yield, because it's one of the most important indicators of recession when that relationship, when the yields on the 2-year are higher than the yields on the 10-year. Over a sustained period of time, as they have been almost, a half a percentage point higher in the past 2 weeks. So just wanted to alert listeners to that in case you're a subscriber to our newsletter and blog. That's all. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate that. It's very good to share that with the listeners and for all those. If you don't get the newsletter, go ahead and get to the website at dgscoins.com and sign up for it. So it's a very good newsletter. Lots of things to say and lots of things to talk about. And the one thing I do like about our newsletter that goes far beyond anybody else's is we don't use sensationalism. You know, we just use the facts and take it for, you know, what it is and try to help you understand what really is going out there. That, you know, it's there is really, and I hate to use the term fake news, but there's a lot of misinterpreted and analysis, and we you know, it's just this, these are the facts, folks. And when you do that, you really look to see that the facts are really not putting the U.S. in a very good position. So take heed.
Yes. And Melody and I may not be certified financial planners, but I'm telling you, if there were one, we would be certified fact checkers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the very few certified planners out there use any common sense. You know, they do what they're told to do. They all, you know, the majority of them all have the same book that they present to their clients. You know, the same, you know, the little, you know, there might be some variance and so forth, but, you know, pretty much there's this percentage of that, this percentage of that, and that's, you know, how, you know, these markets in tune also stay where they are. You know, it's but. Absolutely. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188, you know, and I can't even imagine what's going to happen when we begin to fill up our reserves if we're going to use some more. So the administration is rushing to increase oil supplies ahead of next midterm elections. And administration officials have teased that additional oil can be released from the U.S. Strategic Reserve as part of a response to recent production cuts announced by OPEC. Why don't they just open up what we have instead of using this important thing that we should keep as an emergency? And, you know, the OPEC cut was 2 million barrels a day. That equals to about 2% of the global supply, and has had the White House saying that the Saudi Arabia sided with Putin, which really is not, I don't believe that's true, and pledging that there will be consequences for supply cuts that could prop up energy prices. White House officials say that the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve contains roughly 400 million barrels of oil, and it could come as early as tomorrow, Dave.
Yeah, interesting back and forth between the U.S., some of our allies, and Saudi Arabia. Not sure what lies at the root of some of these decisions, and certainly we're not privy to the conversations, but it's interesting, fascinating to consider the possibilities in any event. We know reserves in the U.S. are at their lowest levels since 1984, after Biden announced back in March the release of, 180 million barrels over a six-month period. The administration's reportedly moving toward an additional release of 10 to 15 million barrels. Now, that may be more symbolic than anything else, because that range wouldn't even cover one full day's use of oil in the U.S., according to the government's own Energy Information Administration. Jared Bernstein, who's a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, said that a past release of oil from the Strategic Reserve contributed to a decline in prices at the pump this summer. That decline ended last month as prices began to rise again, though they've eased somewhat in the past week. Now, Melody, I haven't seen any papers, empirical papers, that show the relationship or the correlation, the cause-effect of, you know, the March release and the prices coming down a few months later, although there is a natural lag in that kind of stuff. We need to see some proof at some point.
Well, you know, and there were many commentators and oil experts who were saying that if it did make any difference, it was just a, you know, a day or two, you know, it wasn't any long term impact on the oil prices, and that the oil prices would just, you know, any impact that it had, would just, they, you know, oil would turn around and continue to go up. I mean, I think the biggest impact is I do believe people are cutting back. And I do believe that that probably has a little bit more impact than anything else. The demand just isn't there. And, of course, you got a lot of the paper trading, too. Lots of times when you get these big, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but please don't. But if I, I'm just kidding. But correct me, no, truly, it's a lot of paper trading. When you see something move, I mean, sure, you got the fundamentals underneath it that's, you know, making the paper traders do what they do. But, you know, they go long. And it pushes these prices higher and higher and higher. And it takes it away from what the reality of the true price is. And you know, then it affects, even though it's paper trading, it still affects what people pay for their gasoline, what oil company, what gas stations pay, and so forth. It does push it up, and then they start shorting the product. And then you see the big drops, and then it does mellow out to a where the real price really should be. So, yeah, I'm thinking the real price of oil is probably around between $80 and $90. And still, they, for some reason, they start pushing it higher, or the fundamentals of the gasoline and oil begin to work on their own. And I don't see it going lower. And so,
for what it's worth,
yes,
I agree with your factual statements.
I mean,
we talk a lot about on this program, not often about options trading in the commodity markets, in oil. We talk a lot about the stocks, stock market. But it's the same thing. I mean, it's a legal form of market manipulation. And that's where having someone of the caliber of Melody telling you, you know, what's going on between the lines is so important, because there often is more to the story than what the corporate barons are providing in print. So,
and, you know, I mean, we've seen J.P. Morgan, look at Deutsche Bank, look how they messed with the metals market.
Right.
And, you know, they get fined for it, and that's how they do it. They can work it to the upside and to the downside. And, you know, supposedly there was these things in there to keep that from happening. But, hey, you know, everybody turns a blind eye and so forth. And you're right. It's a legal way of a manipulation. And but gas prices that we're at right now are still extremely high. But it was nice to see a little relief, no matter what the cause, you know, where we got that relief from. But taking away more from the reserve, I believe, in my opinion, is wrong. It's there for a reason. It's going to have to be filled up sooner than later. And with all the war talk and everything else that's going on, I sure hate to see that shrink, where there's absolutely no emergency to be withdrawing down on that reserve, and the only thing they're using it for is the election. So, and that is wrong. You know, we talk about the dollar rising and the impact that it has on all around the world. You know, we've seen, and we've talked about this yesterday, we talked about it last week, I mention it all the time. You want to know why our oil prices are down a little bit? Well, it's because, you know, the dollar is strong, and it makes those imports cheaper. That's probably the real reason why we've seen a drop. I don't know if that's true. It has a big impact on it. We've seen the cost of living in Cairo. That has soared so much that one security guard had to send his wife and daughter to live with his parents about 70 miles away just to save money. I remember they did that in Greece when they were having their problems. They were sending the families away to other places because they couldn't afford them. You know, the father stayed behind trying to work two jobs, you know, sharing apartments, cutting back on their food because prices have doubled. And the problem is there's no other alternative. You know, and there's people all around the world because our strong dollar is putting them in this position. It's not only our strong dollar, it's also their governments. You know, they're in the same boat as, you know, all the other ones.
Fiat currency, you mean?
Fiat currencies, the inflation, debt. So, and when you have a country that is a one world reserve currency and they use our currency, yeah, it makes it difficult. And that's why you're going to have a country like China, in addition to some of the other ones, you know, where they've been crying about not having, where one government should not have the reserve currency, you know, and that's what I believe they'll have a basket of currencies to mellow it out, but backed by gold, something a little different than what they have now, because the one the basket of currency that we talk about now, there's only, what, 6-8 countries in that one?
Yeah, I believe 7.
Yeah, so there'll be a lot more in the things to come, but a strong dollar, it makes it really bad for the rest of the world. And how long do you think the rest of the world is going to put up with it? The dollar is up 18% so far this year, a 20-year high. So, and you know, we talk about, and that's in the basket of currencies that we talk about every day, Dave. So, amazing.
It is. You know, the reason for the dollar's rise this year, no mystery. To combat high inflation, the Fed's raised its short-term interest rate 5 times this year, and is signaling at least 2 more by the end of the year. And that's led to higher rates on a wide range of U.S. government and corporate bonds, certainly luring more investors, and thus driving up the U.S. fiat currency. And most other currencies are a lot weaker by comparison, especially in poor countries. You know, the India's rupee has dropped 10% this year against the dollar, the Egyptian pound about 20%, Turkish lira 28%. It was higher earlier in the year. It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's happened before. The soaring dollar in 2022, though, is uniquely painful. And it's adding to inflationary pressures around the world when prices were already soaring. Disruptions to energy and agriculture markets caused by Putin's war just magnifies supply constraints stemming from the pandemic recession and the subsequent struggle to recover.
I can't believe we're heading into the first break already. We probably say that every day in this program. It just goes by so fast. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm taking what they're giving because I'm working for a living.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home. Oh, mercy, mercy,
and welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival and my dog, Ruby. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for the newsletter and give us a call. I wanted to touch on this just briefly, Dave, as we there's a couple things we didn't get to. And one is it's kind of interesting about especially our age group where you can buy hearing aids over the counter. Really?
How about that?
Are they good hearing aids or are they, you know, the kind that look like a helmet?
I'll let you know tomorrow. I'm heading out to my local CVS to see if what they have in stock. Oh. After the program.
But can't you just buy them online now, too?
I don't know. I presume you can. I don't know. I was assuming you had to have a prescription, but I don't know.
Well, that's pretty. So is most of your drug stores. What are the costs going to be?
I'll let you know that, too. No clue.
Okay. All right. Well, so if you're out there and you're having to turn up the radio a little bit louder every day, well, you know what you can do now. You can go to your local drugstore and pick up one of those hearing aids. Do you think they'll transmit stuff into our brains?
Oh, boy. Yeah, make sure you read the small print.
Yeah. Well, you know, this I really thought was interesting. We didn't get a touch the ability to touch on this much yesterday. But Xi Jinping's third term will be different. Would you like to tell the listeners about this one, Dave?
Well, you know, it looks like President for Life Xi, well, at least his third term ruling China, won't be based on generating the kind of economic growth that defined the world economy in the last couple of decades. China's been used to driving economic decision-making around the world from investments made by Australian iron miners and German automakers to the planting patterns of Argentine and Iowan soybean farmers to the barring of decisions of the U.S. government, which China happens to be a massive creditor to. Xi is all but certain to break with the traditional two-term limit for the country's leaders. He's expected to be named to a third five-year term at the twice-a-decade Congress for Leaders of the ruling Communist Party, which recently got underway. That, again, will extend his tenure for another 5 years. Analysts saying that will cement his revival of a personalized authoritarian style of leadership over the world's most populous country. Now, for decades, Communist Party members, who interestingly make up just 7% of China's population, have based party legitimacy on China's massive economic growth, which, to its credit, has lifted nearly 800 million of its people out of extreme poverty over that period of time. Everything's relative, but poverty is poverty, even though it's at a lower income level in that country. But now China's economy isn't just slowing quickly, it's seriously struggling. For one thing, Xi's own zero COVID policy and the repeated, massive, and often incredibly harsh lockdowns of Chinese cities that serve as their economic engine. That's really hobbled activity there, Melody. Then you got the housing market, which accounts for as much as 30% of GDP. once related industries are factored in. That's in deep disarray. Prices dropping, developers teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. Longer-term prospects for economic growth look equally dismal, as collapsing birth rates there will saddle it with lopsided demographic, similar financial issues as Japan. And if we get to this story, Russia, too. Downbeat outlook for the Chinese economy is a key reason the Communist Party has shifted the storyline that justifies its monopoly on power away from the economic performance toward a narrative that emphasizes restoring the country to its rightful place as a great power. A couple interesting things about that. One, beware Taiwan. And two, I mean, when was it a great power? I mean, not years ago, not decades ago, centuries ago, perhaps, during the couple dynasty ages. But modern day history, particularly military, I mean, certainly its might has grown, but as a great power, I'm not so sure. In any event, his opening address to the Party Congress on Sunday, Xi said that economic development remains the party's top priority in governance, quote unquote. It was the same language that other Chinese leaders have used since the early 2000s. Well, some analysts thought that Xi would skip that statement this year and signal a more serious pivot away from growth to security as the top concern for the party policymakers. So, China observers are looking out for any announcement on who will replace retiring Premier Li Keqiang. Was once considered the country's top economic official in the Politburo Standing Committee. That's the seven-member group at the heart of political power in China. And I guess you'd call them the lords to whom Xi reports.
I didn't know he reported to anyone, but
I guess
there has to be some accountability or the pretense of some.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk about the younger generation, Dave. And I don't know. That's what you wrote about in the levity is golden. It's the Gen Zers. I don't know how much credibility they have, but there you go. There's your opening.
Well, I guess, you know, actions speaking louder than words. I don't know. It's wild economy, confusing job market. Well, they're apparently tanking some Gen Zers' expectations to get married, have kids, or even adopt a pet, for God's sake.
Almost. What is? Well, excuse me. What is the age bracket for Gen Zers?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I forgot to look that up before the program. I thought it was the 18 to 25. Group the 25 might be on the low end, but I thought the millennials started at somewhere in the 20s. So, but young and a good chunk are in their 20s, and 9 out of 10 of them believe a recession is on the horizon. So, well, good for them, I guess. In any event, that's according to the Too Big to Fail Goldman Sachs 2022 Global Internship Survey of about 2,500 summer interns. So many of them appear to be working to recession-proof their future careers. Some are reconsidering big life milestones too, Melody. And in 2021, 88% of Goldman interns said they expected to get married or establish a formal relationship in the next 10 years. I guess that means engaged. Among the intern class of 2022, that expectation plummeted to just 45%, nearly just down by one half. Meanwhile, 60% last year had expectations to get a pet, 57% said they'd have children in the next decade.
Getting a pet, that's a big expectation.
I know, that's
I'm glad that's number one on your life goals.
It's a beautiful thing to be young again. Well, look, my heart. The intern class of 2022, those expectations dropped to just 31% getting a pet and 25% expecting to become parents. So when you go to your local SPCA and see the crates overcrowded, you can blame the Gen Zers. They're worried about, I guess, being able to take care of them with their busy and upward mobile lives. In any event, why is this happening? Some people are thinking, well, it's the bad news on the economy. So they're no longer focused on these longer-term milestones. And besides, I mean, getting married, certainly, settling down, buying a house, I mean, they do take financial stability. In response to news of this god-awful inflation, the coming layoffs, 74% of future grads say they're most concerned about finding a job that offers them stability and a good salary. So long story short, Melody, Gen Zers aren't prioritizing romantic relationships, or if they're open to one, they want it to happen organically. Now, there's more to this story, but as there is in love and relationships, I'm going to leave that to mystery.
Well, I did look up that the Generation X is 9 to 24.
9 to 24 is X. Okay, so millennials.
Oh, Gen Zers. I say X? I meant Gen Z.
9 to 24.
Okay.
9 to 24. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. 9. So are these opinions based on 9-year-olds?
I got to believe these are all college graduates.
All right. Well, again, higher heating bills are coming. Natural gas, we've seen, we talked about how it fell today. And the Energy Information Administration forecasts that households using natural gas as their primary home heating fuel, which is, nearly half of all households, guess what? Your heating costs, 28%.
Bah.
Mm-hmm. How about that? Home heating oil users, just 4% of households, primarily in the Northeast, will feel a similar sting, with heating bills up 27% to $2,354. That's a lot. U.S. natural gas prices, we saw, they really have tumbled, and we've seen a warmer October, and maintenance-related shutdowns of LNG export terminals sort of boosted domestic supplies, Dave.
Yeah, but wholesale natural gas is still up 68%.
Wow.
So far this year. It's nuts. Yeah. So the experts say the coming prices are going to be a big headache for politicians, especially those running for office in November, and for Fed policymakers trying to control inflation. So it's ugly out there.
Well, speaking of inflation, we bring this almost every day to you, and I think we should. I think it's very important. Again, food prices, 13% up. Cereals and bakery products are up more than 16%. Dairy is up just shy of 16%. Non-alcoholic beverages, 13%. Fruits and vegetables, now over 10%. Meat, poultry, fish, eggs are all up 9%. So, I mean, these are, so what do people do? They buy fewer items. They don't get as much. They don't spend as much because they can't. So we're at a turning point when it comes to food shopping. For a while, inflation was mainly changing what types of items consumer bought, maybe more generics, maybe a cheaper cut of meat. But now people are beginning to buy less. Now, this is coming from the food and beverage analyst at Morning Consult, Emily Moquin. And she conducted the survey where these figures came from. People are starting to think about what they truly need and what can wait. And it certainly is the opposite of the pantry loading that we saw in 2020.
Empty shelves. Now it's pantry unloading, I guess.
But the shelves are still bare.
I know. Interesting. You buy less and work your way through what remains of the old stockpile. Ugh. Nearly one quarter of those surveyed said they're often buying fewer items at the grocery store, largely to save money. And that's up about 10 percentage points from last October. Of course, it's particularly worrying the lower your income is. Percentage of shoppers who worry their food will run out before they have money to buy more increased to 42 from 35%. So watch those credit card balances, ladies and gentlemen. Some consumers inevitably buying food on credit. Certainly not an ideal plan, the time of soaring interest rates, especially when there's so much credit card debt already out there, to the tune of $1.165 trillion, to be exact. That's an average of $7,100 per cardholder. Of course, that's just a drop in the bucket of personal debt, Melody. Total personal debt in the U.S., about $24 trillion. An average of $71,700 per U.S. citizen. Wow. And, of course, that doesn't include the gross U.S. national debt of over $31 trillion, which adds just another modest $93,000 to U.S. citizens' tab.
And then that's their numbers. What's the real numbers? What are the real numbers?
Perhaps the IRS ought to send a golden shovel with our refunds.
Yeah, maybe. Well, you know, this sort of gets my goat. This is something we're running out of time. So, you know, I usually leave it this time. So maybe you can finish it up when we come back. But there's a group of semiconductor companies, and it includes Intel, that lobbied Congress to pass a $52 billion chip stimulus bill earlier this year. Remember that? It was going to bring back all of these companies so they could build chip plants. We talk about it. And, you know, they were going to get all the stimulus and create all these new jobs. Well, now, just before the funding applications open, the nation's largest semiconductor company is planning a major reduction in its workforce. But yet they're still going to receive the billions in federal subsidies. So you fire some, so you get the money from the government, and then you can hire the same ones back, so you're not creating any jobs whatsoever. All on the backs of the U.S. taxpayer. Thousands of Intel employees are expected to be laid off later this month to cut costs amid a steep decline in demand for PC processors, some divisions including sales and marketing. 20% of their staff. Intel was under, you know, of course, from investors. Their share value has fallen more than 50% this year. So, yeah, you know, they can't absorb their loss. They can't hurt those, you know, shareholders. The company posted a net loss of $454 million in the second quarter. And it is just another disgusting display of corporate welfare. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody. This final segment is dealing with other client business. You can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. Let's finish up that story on Intel that Melody was talking about right before the break. I mean, analysts are predicting more grim news to come out of Intel's upcoming third quarter earnings report, with an expected quarter revenue drop of about 15%. Even so, the reported job cuts do come at an awkward time for Intel, given that the company lobbied heavily for the subsidies and committed $20 billion to build a manufacturing mega site on the outskirts of Columbus, Ohio, earlier this year. The move also puts Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger in a difficult position. Why? Well, guess who received a $179 million compensation package last year? CEO Pat Gelsinger. In December, he lobbied Congress to pass the funding, co-signing a big tech letter to lawmakers that said federal subsidies would be, quote, supporting millions of jobs for Americans, unquote. Multinational chipmaker had almost 114,000 employees as of July and plans to apply for federal funding in February when the Commerce Department starts dispersing the subsidies and tax breaks to companies seeking to build these factories across the U.S. An Intel spokesperson said, "We expect the Intel Ohio site to create 3,000 Intel jobs and 7,000 construction jobs." We'll have to follow the math closely to see what base they're subtracting or adding the numbers from. Anyway, Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics said this was certainly foreseeable. The Biden administration could have put in conditions that were not going to give grants to companies that are cutting back their capital outlays or firing workers. But there's nothing like that in the bill. Now, where to next? This is from an article that I wrote in this week's American Survival newsletter. Last week's meeting of the IMF and World Bank weren't exactly the equivalent of an inaugural ball. In fact, apparently there wasn't much festiveness at all. Instead, there reportedly was and is a deep sense of foreboding among the world's financial elite. That's according to Axios' Neil Irwin and Courtney Brown, who added that one Near East financial official said at a Group of 30 event on Saturday, "We have entered an era of enduring uncertainty and fragility." Now, Irwin and Brown warned that leaders around the globe face a situation in which the policy toolkit of the 2010s no longer readily available. fiscal and monetary policy is constrained by the pandemic, the war, and climate change. On the one hand, things in the nation's capital appeared on the surface similar to how they looked before the pandemic was unleashed over 2 years ago. Had limos lining up at luxury hotels, at crowded gates at Dulles International Airport. That was for the Saturday night Lufthansa flights to Frankfurt. Too big to fail banks throwing top shelf receptions attended by the badge wearing people in dark suits and cocktail dresses. And you get the picture. But the challenges that now lie beneath that growing unstable surface have changed in a profound way since then. The Federal Reserve and their international peers are aggressively, I might even say obsessively, raising interest rates to try to bring down inflation after a decade that saw central banks trying novel and, in many instances, untested methods to goad prices higher. Boy, did that ever work. As a result, Brown and Irwin note that global bond markets are pricing in substantially higher rates, leaving governments and other borrowers less room to maneuver. U.S. dollar has soared in value this year, as we mentioned earlier in the program, and that's putting dangerous stress on the entire world financial system. I mean, just ask the holders of any foreign currency how their fiat is doing against the dollar these days. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva told a group of 30 elites, quote, "It is very telling that the tougher the environment becomes, the easier it is for people to remember my last name and pronounce it correctly." Yep, don't try and hide. The 2008 financial crisis and the slow recovery that came after were certainly memorable for the pain they caused tens of millions of households. But the economic tools were reasonably well suited to addressing that pain. As Brown and Irwin point out, it was fine to spend money and cut rates when inflation was low, when demand for government bonds seemed bottomless. Well, and now the fundamental challenge confronting policymakers today is that these problems can't necessarily be solved by a Wizard of Oz turning financial and economic dials behind curtain number three. Instead, we're facing numerous limitations like fewer workers, lots of them, significant supply chain disruptions, and yes, another major war. Combined, they're acting to force central banker into a sense of compelled sadism to bring down demand and thus inflation. So, trussonomics, we hardly knew ye. I mean, to a large degree, the recent events in the UK seemed like a warning sign of what's to come in other rich countries. I mean, no wonder Janet Yellen's reportedly leaving the Biden administration soon. Bond markets essentially forced the Brit government to back off its desired tax-cutting plans, lest deficits grow and borrowing costs escalate further. According to the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, the problem is that the supply side has shrunk, particularly the labor force, and the economy has been hit by a huge shock to the national real income from the war. So, at the moment, the world's economic challenges are constrained by factors that foreign ministers, finance ministers, pardon me, and central bankers just can't control. After all the drama and upheaval in financial markets, almost none of the tax cut plans proposed under rookie UK Prime Minister Liz Truss will actually see the light of day. Newly installed Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt today said that just two pieces of the original plan would remain in the end. And as Churchill would no doubt quip, the rest is history. Notably, Hunt, not Churchill, added, a proposal to help households and businesses deal with soaring energy bills will also be scaled back, costing taxpayers significantly less than planned. Brown and Irwin note that the UK's flip-flop caps an extraordinary saga in which financial markets all but forced officials to scale back spending plans, a dynamic not seen in a developing nation in decades. Yeah, it's essentially a supply side gamesmanship, trickle down economics, which we know from the 80s does not work. They believe it may also be a cautionary tale for other countries, Italy being a prime example, who just may be more circumspect about their own spending plans in the coming months. Foreign bond yields have risen across much of the world, thanks largely to central bank action, and fear of financial stagnation, even calamity, are rising. Is there any way out of this mess without actually throwing the U.S. and global economy into a deep recession? Well, time will tell for sure. But in Friday's What a Rush of Gold Silver blog, we'll take a dive into how some believe we might be able to move the needle on inflation without bringing on a bloody, gory result. Now, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers is worried that quiet quitters are hurting worker productivity. A veteran economist who previously served as president of Harvard University and, well, a chief economist at the World Bank, Summers is an unlikely figure, to be sure. We'll be talking about this new phrase that has caught fire on social media, quiet quitters. But in response to Nobel laureate Paul Krugman's Friday New York Times column, Summers said he believes that quiet quitting is one of the key reasons that worker productivity fell over 4% in the second quarter. Now, the unofficial term is applied to people who give up on going above and beyond at their jobs and just do the bare minimum. Quiet quitting took off on social media platforms earlier this year. After years of receiving rise and grind and lean in work advice, 80% of Gen Z and millennials say the trend appeals to them. Well, Summers fears that these quiet quitters will exacerbate the already elevated inflation, forcing the Fed to continue raising interest rates right into recession. Summers wrote, given dismal productivity growth likely caused by quiet quitting, wage inflation will have to come down significantly if sustained months near 2% inflation is to be attained. He added, I do not understand the basis for believing this is likely without a meaningful recession. Now, in a 2005 paper, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who at the time served as president of the San Francisco Fed, described the connection between falling worker productivity and inflation that Summers is talking about today. She wrote that when workers' productivity drops, it forces businesses to hire more employees to complete the same job. And that leads to rising costs, which businesses then pass on by rising prices. It's a vicious cycle that Yellen admitted can cause upward pressure on inflation for a, quote, considerable period. Now, Summers' argument about falling worker productivity exacerbating inflation has been backed up by research. His comments about how quiet quitting has factored in were immediately questioned by some of his fellow economists. Progressives who criticize Summers say it's not just as simple as higher unemployment being the macroeconomic solution. Justin Jalbert, a senior economist at Fast Market, said that it may not be the best policy to look at trends like quiet quitting that aren't backed up by empirical evidence when discussing Fed policy. In response to Summers' comments, Jalbert said, it's pretty funny to see heavyweight economists dishing out critiques of those not following empirical evidence on inflation from traditional macro frameworks, yet in the same breath, assuming quiet quitting is real and not a meme from social media. It's like, a sick day call-in in the old days. Jalbert added that Summers deserves credit for correctly predicting the rise in inflation, but that he may be just clinging to labor market anecdotes that fit his worldview, even when the evidence is lacking. Now, a former Fed economist, Claudia Sahm, says disinflation is coming. Fed needs to back off. It's done enough. She wrote that in the column yesterday, responding to Summers. Crazy, crazy stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Last year, 34% of workers said they were engaged at work, while only 16 said they were actively disengaged. And that's with remote working having taken hold in many sectors of the economy. Gallup's worker engagement polls from the past two decades consistently show that despite any recent TikTok trends, workers have become more engaged at work, not less. Now, that trend may change for sure, but for now, there's limited evidence that quiet quitting, which many have pointed out is, in fact, people just doing their jobs, is having any real impact on the economy. Adam Ozimek, who's chief economist at the bipartisan public policy organization Economic Innovation Group, said this, "I think more likely it is actual quitting and resulting high levels of turnover and onboarding. And this will come down with rate hikes and labor supply growth. Indeed, it already is." Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs, who will talk about the bionic pancreas and diabetes. Thanks always to our producer Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to Financial Survival. Frost coming tonight along the eastern, northeastern mid-Atlantic. Cover your plants if you want to see them tomorrow. I'm Dave Allen. Have a great night. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I got me your welcome.